Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Greetings, dear listener. Dear listener. This is Ben from Gravity Commons. I'm here with Matt.
Mm-hmm.
How's it going, Matt?
It's going okay today, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. It's been cold here in Indianapolis as we record this.
Man. 14 degrees today.
Yeah, a little cold spell hitting Indy. I never feel like I can really complain. I'm from Minnesota. I've got a lot of relatives that still live in Minnesota. And, you know, the town that my relatives live in is on my phone, on my weather app. Is, you know, I just swipe over to see what temperature it is in Minnesota. And it's always colder. And so, but anyway, but I, you know, there's a low key pride I have.
Oh, I know.
Growing up in a very cold state.
I see it. It's all over you. And it's definitely there like in an inverse way when it gets warm and hot and sunny.
Yeah. That's when I can complain.
You get real grumpy.
Although it does get muggy. I grew up in southern Minnesota, and it gets muggy in the summer. It does.
Yeah.
Doesn't quite get as cold, but it's, I don't know, if it has to do with where the glaciers came through there. There's not that many hills, you know? It's kind of flat.
Yep.
A lot of lakes, a lot of mosquitoes. It can get muggy in the summer. So
yeah.
That's how it goes. Well, anyway, dear listener, we are on the third part. I think this is going to be the final part of our little mini series that Matt and I are doing here on leaving white evangelicalism.
Yeah,
the spaces that we both grew up in. And so far, we've kind of talked about these articles that we've referenced, and there's, you know, like an academic journal article that. That kind of explained a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then a Washington Post article about sort of maybe some of the things that have changed about what it means to be an evangelical. Referenced, you know, for example, there's some Muslims who claim to be evangelical. So it's very clearly taken a turn from the theological to a sort of a political definition. If there are people who are literally from different religions, who say that they're evangelicals. But on this final, we kind of went about this, I don't know, maybe in an inverse way.
Circuitously.
But, yeah. You know, I don't know if it's inductively or deductively, but anyway, my daughter was learning about those in college and she was like, hey, do you remember anything about this? Can you help me with this assignment? I was like, oh man, you're going to have to remind me of how that all works. But, on this final part of this series, we want to kind of take it from the, you know, historiography that we've been talking about and the sort of the news articles and the cultural observations down to personal experience, because this whole thing started with an article. I guess our whole idea of doing this series started with this article that you wrote on your Substack on how I left white evangelicalism and how it left me.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so there's a sort of a personal anecdotal playing out of some of these larger dynamics that we've been talking about on the series so far.
Yes.
Yeah. You want to say anything else about it before we dive in?
Yeah, I've already indicated that I was surprised when I felt like I did a sort of a ceremonial leaving of white evangelicalism by going into the mainline, that not only mainline people thought I was evangelical, but also people who followed my work or writing or speaking, but weren't necessarily, but they also considered me evangelical. And so it was a little bit of a, you know, kind of a, interesting. Yeah. And that caused me to maybe reflect on this more. Yeah. And that's how I wrote the Substack.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, the Substack kind of starts with you kind of being flabbergasted in 2016 when we found out that, you know, 81% of the evangelical voters in the exit polls said that they voted for Donald Trump, and you were kind of flabbergasted about that.
Yeah, I was. I think with a lot of people, I think I was, you know, I wasn't an evangelical when Bill Clinton was in office, but I was really, really aware of how the religious right was just scandalized, right? By his...
Right. His, the Monica Lewinsky, the
affair.
Scandal. Yep, the affair.
You know?
Yeah, in quotes.
and I'm actually not quite sure what to call that, because there's like power differentials there. She was an intern. Yeah. He was a president. You know, is that assault? It was consensual, but
it's
how
fascinating how
does consent work when there's you know,
we're way more aware of those issues today than we were in 92?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm actually not I actually don't want to argue with how Monica Lewinsky frames it. So however she frames it, I'm happy to frame it like that. Sure. Anyway. That being said, you know, the moral majority religious right was scandalized by that. And then to see, for instance, just taking one person, to see the different way that James Dobson talked about Bill Clinton's relationship with Monica Lewinsky and Donald Trump's, serial adultery, having, being credibly accused of sexual assault, right, not at the time, but now convicted of rape, paying for abortions, et cetera.
Yeah.
Just the moral reasoning was like striking to me, just shocking. Yeah. And I honestly couldn't believe it. Like, it wasn't like the first time I'd ever thought about it, but it was so striking to me. I think, Ben, it was so striking to me. And 81% felt like such a betrayal.
Yeah.
It felt like such a, like my family betrayed.
Yeah.
Who we said we were, you know, I think it was a, you know, we all have those moments where we're like, we have to figure out how to make sense of reality according to our scripts and frames. And we just kind of, sometimes we ignore it and sometimes we change it and sometimes we make room for it, you know, but the MAGA event of the election of 2016, really, I couldn't shake it.
Yeah.
It profoundly impacted me. And I knew that I had to figure out what is going on.
Yeah. Yeah. And that that kind of, you know, set upon, you know, a journey. I know that Jesus and John Wayne, Kristen Dumais' book was part of that. All of that kind of thing. But yeah, you were talking about, you know, just starting to, you know, piece together things that maybe other communities, other individuals have kind of seen and known for a long time. But you're talking about the dissonance between thinking of yourself and the kind of the church movement that you were part of, you know, along the lines of the Bebbington Quadrilateral, as we said in the first episode of this series. Like, it's primarily about these four theological commitments. That's kind of what this is about.
Right.
And, you know, the 81% and, you know, most sort of well-known evangelical leaders sort of falling in line and treating Trump very differently from Clinton was sort of this tell.
Yeah.
Something different is going on here.
A representative tell. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, something's different going on here than just, I don't know. Like, it can't just be that we're a theological movement dedicated to this quadrilateral.
Yeah.
There must be something else motivating this move.
Yeah. Yeah, because at the time, we already talked about this last week, and it was in the show notes last week, the redefining the history and historiography of the American evangelicalism in the era of the religious right by Matthew Avery Sutton. We talked about that last time, but I very much was a tried and true believer of what, you know, the historians like Mark Knoll were writing about.
Right.
That there was this broad, general, worldwide consensus of these theological distinctives that defined a very culturally diverse movement.
Yeah.
And that we we were united by those commitments, those Christian theological commitments, regardless of if we were from England or Australia or Nigeria or Texas.
Right.
And it was, and so there was plenty of, you know, there was unity in essentials and then tolerance for like things that are non-essential, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And I was, and I believe that the essentials had to do with things like the resurrection of Jesus from the dead and the authority of the scriptures. Yeah, yeah, things like that. So I thought that the move, but MAGA and 81% was a crisis in that story for me, because there were minority reports.
Yeah,
and I mean that from like a, I mean that using that phrase as like a, like part of our nomenclature. Like there were reports that were not well attested, but on the periphery, but also from people who are considered minorities.
Right.
That
you're not referring to the Tom Cruise movie?
No, I'm not. But
that was a pretty good movie.
Yeah, it was. that white evangelicalism isn't who they said they were.
Right. Yeah, and so you know. In this article, you kind of go on from there to talk about some of the stuff we've already talked about, how mm-hmm. there was these ideological, political forces that created the sort of the modern white conservative evangelical movement.
Yeah.
It wasn't just, they weren't just reading their Bibles and hearing from God. And it didn't spring purely from theology, that there were all these other forces that galvanized this movement: desegregation, the overturning of interracial marriage, you know, women being able to get divorces, so some of the civil rights stuff, you know, gender rights, you know, for women, sexuality in the 1950s and 60s, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
We've talked a little bit about that, like how those ideological forces, you know, according to historians, really did shape this movement, perhaps more than or in addition to the theological commitments.
Right.
Yeah. And I think then, you know, part of what you talk about in this article is that, you know, that you decided to test it rather than just say like, yeah, I guess this is all, you know, I guess this is all bunk. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And so you wanted to actually call people, your evangelical brothers and sisters, to, you know, like, hey, don't forget, these are our commitments.
Yeah.
You know? So if these, you know, if these are the things that we say we're committed to, you know, the experiment was, hey, if I'm part of the chorus of voices that's pointing this out,
yes,
we would make things right. You know, we'd rectify our wrongs. We'd be faithful. We'd realize, oh yeah, we were wrong about Trump and we should, you know, we'll repent now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So
how did that go?
spoiler alert, Darth Vader is Luke's dad. Yeah, so I just want to pause here for a second because I wanted to actually verify this, but I also was embarrassed. Mm-hmm. I also felt complicit.
Yeah.
I also felt culpable. Now, this is difficult. We've talked about this in the podcast before. It's difficult for me to name my relationship to the wrongs I saw my family doing.
Family meaning evangelicalism.
Yeah. I'm using family as a metaphor there.
Not your wife and kids.
There's some degree of culpability, of complicity, of responsibility, but it's not by direct agency. And so part of what I was attempting to do was, you know, are these minority reports true? Have I been wrong about my family and who I said I have been wrong about myself, you know? Yeah. Two, if I'm wrong, what's the appropriate response? Mm-hmm. Like, how do I live faithfully? Mm-hmm. How do I follow Jesus? What would a faithful repentance look like, right?
Yeah. As a member of this family.
As a member of this family.
And as someone who, you know, you weren't on the radio advocating for, you know, people to vote for Donald Trump. You know what I mean? Like you weren't doing some of the things that you saw as most egregious, but you are associated with these people and affiliated with them.
Yeah.
And so what does it look like for you to,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
Yeah. Live faithfully.
Right. So, yeah. So I started to just talk about the ways in which primarily women and people of color, people of culture, were treated in my denomination and in our country and in our history, mm-hmm. and advocated for telling the truth about it and rectification for it. You know, this involved mistreatment of women in our denomination who were ordained but were slandered and despised and ridiculed, vilified, dishonored, disrespected. Yeah. It included the way that Black and brown people are treated and advocating for justice there. Mm-hmm. It included the normalization of sexual predation, the way that white evangelicals, not exclusively, but generally, ordinarily, regularly, dealt with allegations of abuse in their churches and mm-hmm. sexual abuse in their churches, was not good. Like we weren't taking seriously the cries of little ones who said that the leaders had caused them to stumble. Instead of treating it as an offense that a millstone could be tied around their neck and thrown into the sea, oftentimes people who consider themselves survivors were marginalized, scapegoated, vilified, etc. So I'm seeing all these things happen up close and a little farther away from me in our white conservative evangelical circles. And, you know, at the same time, we're running Gravity Commons, which is then called Gravity Leadership, and we're training leaders. And I'm noticing like all of these very authoritarian, what I would now call like supremacist, heavy-handed command and control postures, instincts, habits, practices that I experienced as abusive. Mm-hmm. And I'm noticing aren't doing good work, right? So there's all these layers to me trying to advocate or speak out about or name appropriately, calling general some kind of response, but also people close to me to response. And that went on for several years. Probably from 2016 to 2020 or so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, there were other layers to this, Ben, how COVID was politicized, right? And, we were, wearing a mask became oppressive or something you did if you were, didn't trust God,
right?
Things like that.
Yeah.
Right. And then I don't know if you remember, Ben, but the summer of 2020 or the spring and summer of 2020 was like sort of the epicenter of, in many ways, of like the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah. George Floyd.
Yeah.
Happened right. Was it right before, right after COVID? That was like May.
Yeah. Or June. Yeah. 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 And just being, taking a position on that, And all these things, right? I think I also advocated for the poor and talked about increasingly how mammon is at work in our political economy, that in oppressive ways. Like we don't organize for human flourishing. We organize for certain people to make a lot of money and others to make a lot less, and how unjust the scriptures say that is. So in these experiments, I'm Prospero. Hey, we've talked about them before. They're an organization that offers faith-based counselor training. They believe that the aim of counseling is real transformation, not just symptom management or removal. Their counselor training courses equip you to help people to be great lovers of others, to understand why they do what they do, to be emotionally healthy, and to live out their identity as someone deeply loved and delighted in by God. All their training is rooted in the belief that Jesus is a source of life and that we can be a part of his work of healing and restoration.
And for pastors and ministry leaders, their training is a proven way to identify the people in your church who might be gifted for lay counseling, and it can be a powerful way to help make your church into a genuine healing community. They provide all the training and the supervision that allows your leaders to do great work and to free up pastoral staff from needing to do all the pastoral counseling in your church. If you are interested, you can go to respero.org, that's R-E-S-P-E-R-O.org, and click on the counselor training tab.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing. More transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
I'm trying to notice the people that Jesus noticed, trying to bring the scriptures to those issues, and calling people who say they believe in the things that Jesus taught and the scriptures, trying to call us all into some kind of, you know, intentional, constructive rectification, where our lives or our public square or our churches are out of alignment, and we want to realign, not based upon, you know, the prevailing pop psychological whatever, but based upon our scriptures, mm-hmm. You know, and that was not received well.
Yeah. So the experiment that was the result of the experiment.
The returns were not great.
We'll be right back.
Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, in talking about that, mm-hmm. You know, like you say in the article, by and large, you know, white conservative Christians weren't having it. You know, some individuals were sympathetic, but I mean, this is something that I noticed as well. Is like even people who, and this is one of the things that I noticed is that not just so some of the people that you know. Responded to this were just sort of belligerent in their defense of, you know, just things that are clearly there was no argument about the scriptures. It was just like, you know, an accusation was lobbed, you know, well, you must love, you know, killing babies or, you know what I mean? Like that kind of a thing rather than actually address the scriptures. But there were other people too, that I think were sympathetic and who really agreed, you know, with some of these, like, yeah, of course we should, you know, take care of the immigrant and the poor. And, you know, of course we should do those things, but there was it's almost like the powers that be, it was like everybody understood that you don't really talk about that too loud, even if you agree with it.
Yes.
Because, you know, and I do understand some of the reason, you know, like if this is your job and you don't know what else you would do and you're going to get fired, like I have a lot of sympathy for that. But what that showed me was that there was this power structure that didn't have to do with, hey, let's open the scriptures and argue about this and talk about this,
yeah.
that it had to do with falling into line when it comes to, you know, what the talking heads were saying we all should believe in and how we should all think about this, you know?
Yes.
And so I think that's the thing that discouraged me the most as we went through this was just seeing that as like, oh, it doesn't even matter. You know?
Yeah.
It doesn't even matter that I can articulate and explain this to you, which you know really hurt because I take some pride in my ability to explain things to people.
Yes.
So it's like that doesn't even matter. It doesn't even matter that, you know. So it was just like, oh, this is something different.
Right. So I'm owning that this is a naivete here.
Sure.
But I really thought like I could point to this passage or this theme in the scriptures and we would amend our way of life.
Yeah.
And there was also another part of this too, Ben, that I this wasn't static. This was developing and dynamic and it changed over time. So sure. talking about it as though it was like a flat static thing is probably, doesn't honor what was actually happening. But one of the things that developed within that was I noticed that I had habits of being what I call a white moderate. And I learned that from Martin Luther King, that I was very, very scared. I was very, very scared of taking a side mm-hmm. in the public square. So if I were to critique, for instance, those white Southern racists who turned dogs on black people marching mm-hmm. for civil rights,
right.
I also then would have to mention that, you know, some who are advocating for civil rights use violence and destroy property, and that's not right either. And what we need is neither property destruction or white supremacy. What we need is to come together and be unified. And, Martin Luther King wrote about that kind of language, that kind of posture, that lack of solidarity with people contending for justice. And he talked about the spirit of the white moderate in his letter from a Birmingham jail. And I realized that I did that a lot. And then that also did two things. I had to ask why. Why am I doing that? Who does that do work for? And why does that habit feel so important to me? And then what happens if I transgress that habit? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, let's run an experiment. What if I don't do that? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
What if I bring up Donald Trump's misogyny without also mentioning how, but
some Democrats are accused of sexual assault too.
Or without God's grace, I would be just as a big of a womanizer.
Yeah.
Right? Without doing that, but just saying, look, this is wrong. Christians, we shouldn't support this. Mm-hmm. And then not play both sides or whatabouts or. And boy, that was a huge transgression.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah. What do you mean by that? Like, how did you know that?
Well, what ended up happening is, so I did this because I noticed that a big part of my learning was the way that I had befriended some women, in particular, some women doing anti-violence, abolition, justice work, mm-hmm. and in particular, some black women. And I recognized that the way they spoke to me was different than the way I spoke to other people and other people spoke to me. Mm-hmm. But they were not concerned about me liking them. They weren't trying to be nice. They weren't trying to be funny. They weren't trying to nuance everything. They just said things directly and plainly without it being personal. And I had to reckon with what that speech act did to me.
Yeah.
I wasn't used to not verbally being given the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm. Or like a deference to you and your position or your status or your, you know, whatever.
Or my intent or whatever. Yeah. And I'm not saying like we shouldn't give people the benefit of the doubt. I'm just saying like verbally, like I could say, hey, Ben, you know, we've been friends a long time and, you know, you actually have some of the best words. And, you know, sometimes you talk to me in that, those dulcet baritone reverberations, and it just warms the cockles of my heart. And really, I can think of these three sermons you did that were so encouraging and whatever. And I just wonder, like, what did you, you know, I know your heart's good, but when you said X, Y, and Z, I didn't know what you were saying. Mm-hmm. Would you help me understand that?
Right.
Versus, hey, on Thursday night, you said this to me, and that didn't sit great with me. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about that?
Right.
So there's a huge difference where I'm trying to like massage you. I'm trying to like soften you up. I'm trying to get you to, you know, whatever. Or I'm just like owning where I'm at, inviting you into that.
Yeah.
And we're going, it's like a call-in situation that isn't terrified of confrontation.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's not, you know, like you said, it's like nobody's insulting you or calling you names.
Yeah.
They're just speaking to you about the effect of your actions, for example, or the effect of your words.
Yeah.
And that was new. Yeah. And that was a you said that was a transgression when you tried to do that.
Yeah. Just speaking directly and plainly. Mm-hmm. Without nuance, trying to massage, trying to cajole, trying to placate, trying to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
None of that. The reason I did that is because the people I was learning from were like, that's part of like white body supremacy trauma. Mm-hmm. That we live in like an anxious system, a traumatized system. And the people in that system have power, so it becomes a supremacy system that runs on trauma. And part of this impulse you have to not make the powerful people angry by telling them, hey, that's not okay, you have to always include them with other people so that you're not actually speaking directly to the religious leaders.
Yeah.
Or you're not actually speaking directly to Peter. Or you're not actually speaking directly to the landowners. Right. Or you're not actually speaking directly to King David. You're speaking in general, maybe King David will listen and decide that, you know, killing Uriah was wrong.
Yeah. If I preach a sermon on how we should be, you know, we shouldn't take other people's stuff and we should be really generous. You know, to other people, and you know, everybody's equal in God's eyes.
Yeah.
And you sort of hope that David gets the message rather than saying, you're the man. You know, you like my parable? You're the man. It's very different. I'm struck by, we're recording this. I can't remember when this is going to come out, but we're recording this Friday after the inauguration. Mm-hmm. And I'm struck by how Bishop Buddy sort of did this kind of thing, a very direct, I mean, her sermon was very gentle, very, she was actually somewhat deferential, you know, just sort of like saying, you know, trying to find common ground. But at the end of her sermon, she just asked that this powerful person, like she actually acquiesced. She said, you are, you know, you have this authority, you have this power. And with it, I would ask that you'd have mercy on people who are scared and have mercy on people who are already marginalized. And are already scared, and who are actually good neighbors and part of our communities.
Yes.
Please have mercy on them. That's all she said, essentially.
Yes.
And the response, like from MAGA folks and from Trump himself, was just unhinged, just insulting, you know, all kinds of stuff. But all she did was make a direct appeal for mercy.
Yeah.
And even that sort of, you know, triggered something.
But she didn't say, and here's some good ideas for leaders like presidents. They should be merciful, they should be benevolent, and they should listen to other people.
Yeah.
You know, she got very specific about groups of people that President Trump's rhetoric and policies and the larger MAGA movement terrifies.
Yes.
And we were on a clergy call yesterday with clergy who were in tears.
Yeah.
Because they represent and are a part of people groups that MAGA rhetoric is targeting.
Yes.
Right? So, yeah. So the issue, she did the transgressive thing, and you'll, yeah. and the response of MAGA and the response of white, some white conservative evangelicals mm-hmm. indicate that she violated something.
Yeah.
Because they're calling her spewing yeah. hatred. Mm-hmm. She's got, a satanic church, a satanic yep. pulpit. She yep. should be on the deportation list.
Yeah. Yeah. And it strikes me that what she was doing was anybody who's preached a sermon knows like what she was doing in her sermon, because she preached a sermon about unity and yeah. some of the foundations of unity, right? And she was speaking, you know, fairly generally about that. It requires, I can't remember, there was three H words, which I also appreciated her alliteration, but it was like, it requires, it was like honesty, it requires humility.
Yeah.
And it requires, I don't know, there's another H word. But anyway, there were these general principles that, you know, are true and good. And if someone was listening, you know, like a President Trump, who, you know, was thinking about their actions, they might, you know, think, oh, well, here's how I could apply this in my life. All she was doing was essentially saying, like, here's a practical application of this
yeah.
that I would ask that you would fulfill.
Yeah.
You know, if you yeah. agree with me about unity, if you agree with me about these things,
yeah.
here's how you can participate.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But that was right. the thing. If she wouldn't have said that, I think her sermon would have been, nobody would have been talking about it.
No.
Yeah.
No. And she, but see, like, you know, she called for mercy on groups of people that are vilified and scapegoated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't do it as eloquently or as pointedly, but that's the kind of thing I was doing. Right. And the response was very similar.
It's very similar. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we were in a non-affirming denomination, and now we're in an affirming denomination with LGBTQ concerns. Mm-hmm. And the non-affirming denomination, I never publicly advocated for an open and inclusive stance, because that was actually against some of the commitments we made to be in that denomination.
Right. So theologically, you weren't saying we should change our minds theologically about this.
No, never did. But I did call out and call people who were not affirming to stop weaponizing gay people in the public square yeah. for political partisan gain.
Yeah. Have mercy on them.
Have mercy on them. Yeah. You don't have to agree with a trans person about how they identify or the pronouns they use, or you don't have to agree with them to decide that it's cruel to use their identity as a scare tactic.
Right.
And that was another example. Like, you know, it was the same thing. It was like a call to mercy. Like, mm-hmm. lay off. I can't go 2 days without seeing another youth pastor or pastor being arrested for child pornography.
Right.
In our family. Mm-hmm. So lay off my trans friends. Who don't have child pornography?
Yeah, like, maybe we don't have as much authority to speak, you know, definitively yeah, on yeah. matters of sexuality than we think.
Right, and you know, one of the heights of this thing was a couple of years ago with the child trafficking movie, and the child trafficking panic was directed towards yeah. gender minorities yeah. when, you know, it turns out the people who funded that and directed that had their own sexual abuses.
Yeah. Just so crazy.
So just calling out that hypocrisy mm-hmm. and saying, let's stop weaponizing these people who don't go to our churches by and large. Right.
Right.
Because they've heard loud and clear from us that God doesn't love you. God hates you.
Yeah.
So they've stayed away. Mm-hmm. Let's stop talking to people who aren't here and start dealing with our own mess. Like judgment right. begins in the household of God.
Yeah.
Right. Better yeah. to pluck out, you know, better to pluck out your own eye, yeah. right? Cut off your own hand.
If you're looking for a group, it should just be like men. We should be saying, what yeah. is wrong with the men?
Yeah. What is wrong with us?
Yeah.
Anyway. Like, yeah. If we can't stop committing sexual crimes, maybe we shouldn't be in leadership.
Yeah. It's just like, let's put a pause on men in leadership until we can figure this out.
Anyway, this stuff felt obvious to me, and it felt like I was operating within the Bebbington Quadrilateral, and it felt like I was operating in Mark Knoll's large theological consensus. Yeah. But I also knew that if the minority reports were correct, all hell would break loose. Mm-hmm. Because this was a transgression of white patriarchal supremacy. Yeah. And turns out.
Yeah. So it turns out that spirit is sort of the animating force.
Yeah.
Without speaking too broadly, but just as a, you kind of have to speak broadly if you're going to talk about something as broad as evangelicalism, you know what I mean? But I think what you're articulating and naming here is that, yeah, the appeals to the Bebbington Quadrilateral, the appeals to scripture fell on deaf ears. Mm-hmm. And that does say something about evangelicalism as a cultural movement.
Yeah.
It says something.
Yeah. So, yeah, it does. And, you know, listener, when we left our denomination, we left lots of friends who agreed with us. And I know lots of people who still are in what are considered evangelical or white evangelical spaces who are really bothered by MAGA and super frustrated with the whole thing. So, generalizations are helpful because I think we can't overgeneralize.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
But we can't overgeneralize. And I think the other thing, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but because, you know, we're talking about leaving, you know, we joined this mainline denomination, but that's not the only faithful thing to do necessarily. You know what I mean?
Right.
We're not like advocating that everybody
vacate
these spaces, because I know there's all kinds of other considerations, and some people feel called to, you know, be a minority report from inside the family, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And I think that's important to say.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, we still have friends that have to watch what they say.
Yep.
Can't actually amen what Bishop Buddy said at the National Cathedral inaugurative prayer service.
Yeah.
Like, they just can't amen what she's saying because it would put a target on them. And so, yeah. There's a complicated relationship that a lot of people have to evangelicalism. But can I kind of share, like, that experiment did two things. One, it helped me clarify that this picture that emerged for me in books like Jesus and John Wayne by Kristen Cobes Jumé, The Color of Compromise by Jamar Tisby, I mean, we all know these books, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was more true than I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And me advocating for these things that really were highlighting the cultural captivity and syncretism of white evangelicalism with white conservatism in the United States was making it increasingly impossible for me to stay where I was. Like, it wasn't tenable long term for me to continue to do what I was doing and stay, because I was increasingly unwanted.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
For sure. Yeah.
And now a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
I think an overlap between our stories is that, I mean, I definitely felt, you know, the same thing of just, I didn't feel as personally, because I wasn't as vocal, you know, on social media and that kind of thing as you were. Just, you know, for various reasons, it's not my style or whatever, but which is fine. But I think for me, it just ended up increasingly feeling like it just wasn't home anymore. You know?
Yeah.
Like, it just wasn't home. And it wasn't I just didn't resonate. I just don't resonate with.
Yeah.
You know,
but it didn't feel like leaving home for college where you're like, screw you, parents. Now I can finally stay out as late as I want. I don't have to live under your oppressive rules anymore.
Right. It wasn't knee jerk and it wasn't easy.
It was more like, for either
of us.
Sorry, Ben, go ahead.
That's okay. I was just saying, like, I think this is an overlap, you know, as we've talked, like there was a real identity crisis and a real, it was disorienting for me to sort of like, this is just who I've been like my whole life and who I've affiliated with. And it's just, it felt sad to me, that it was like, this just isn't home for me anymore.
Yeah.
So yeah, I felt sad about it. I still do. Sometimes.
Do you agree though that it feels like, because I titled the article like, you know, was it How I Left Evangelicalism and How It Left Me?
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Does it feel like both of those things for you, or would you say it differently? Because it feels like, it feels like the people I thought we were, left me.
Yes.
They were saying something in 2014, and then 2024, they weren't actually saying that anymore.
Right. Yeah. It does feel that. I think that's the grief that I sort of slowly felt increasing distance over, you know, over those 8-10 years, whatever it was. Like, it just slowly felt this increasing distance between like the people that I thought were like home base.
Yeah.
But it's almost like they just kept going off in a direction that I was like, wait, I thought we were on this road, you know, like, wait, I thought we were I guess that's the image that comes to mind for me. It wasn't like an overt rejection, like you get out of here.
Right.
But it was more like they just kept like going off on this road that I was like, I thought we were on a different road and I just can't go there with you.
Yeah.
And so I had to look around and say, is anybody else? Anybody else around here?
Yeah. You know? So people left us, but then also too, I had to reckon with the fact that the story I told myself about who I was and what we were about was a very curated, selective story.
Yeah.
And when push came to shove, when a black president came to the White House, we abandoned that story.
Yep. And I think giving people the benefit of the doubt, speaking of the benefit of the doubt, but giving people the benefit of the doubt, I think there are very few overtly malicious, nefarious people, I think, in this movement who know what they're doing, right? And are manipulating behind the scenes. You know, it's like, yeah, we're going to like, this is what we're really mad about. And we're going to manipulate other people to think that it's all theological.
Like very few 1960s comic book villains.
Right. With a mustache they twirl. Very few. But so I think most people probably, even most leaders probably don't realize quite maybe what's animating them. Or why, you know what I mean? Like, and I don't want that to sound too like paternalistic. Like I know what's going on behind the surface for you. But I guess I say that to say like, I just don't think they're villains. I think they are caught up in something that they don't understand. That has effects that they're oftentimes not willing to face.
Yeah. I mean, I think the picture of Jesus weeping over Jerusalem comes to mind for me, and the way he frames it is that like if you'd only known the things that make for peace, but you don't, and so you're advocating for your own destruction,
right?
And so like telling the truth about evil and somebody's responsibility to it, but also weeping over it,
yes. And I think that's a helpful picture. Yeah, that I felt Yeah, I felt called to that because I think the temptations for me are either to like despise, right? Despise that which I'm leaving. It makes it easier to leave if like, you know, there's some self-justification there. Like I'm better than these people.
Yeah.
That's a temptation.
Yeah.
But the other one is to kind of just to refuse to weep, to shut off my heart and just say, eh, here we go. But I'm inspired by Jesus naming it and weeping.
Yeah.
I think it's a helpful picture of how to do this as a human, full human.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, I mean, the other thing too is just, you know, even those people, right, that Jesus is weeping over, you know, I grew up thinking that, you know, the religious leaders, the Pharisees, that kind of thing, were kind of like villains, you know what I mean? Like they were like, you know, like scheming and, you know, all this stuff. And they, you know, in the scriptures, they are plotting. But, you know, I think there's a lot of evidence that says that they thought they were doing God's work. They thought this was the faithful thing to do.
I mean, that's what they say in John 11. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like we gotta take care of this guy because, you know, he's just not being practical.
If we don't scapegoat this person, we'll lose power and we'll lose privilege.
Yeah. And how else is God going to be at work in Israel unless we maintain these things?
Yep. Yep.
That was the assumption.
Good thing that logic no longer animates anybody.
Yeah, I mean, after they wrote John 11, everybody was like, wow.
That was a bad idea. Let's never do that again.
Let's never do that again.
Anyway, so the question then about, you know, the question that started this thing 3 weeks ago, like, are you an evangelical? Like, I guess I have to just say, what do you mean by that? And then let me tell you about, I think I would check it's complicated on Facebook to describe that.
Your relationship status?
Yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, this comes back to somebody left a comment about, so every podcast episode, listener, if you're not part of the Gravity community, I'd invite you to come and sign up, gravitycommons.com/community. Come and sign up. It's free. And we talk about podcast episodes. Mm-hmm. We talk about a lot of stuff. Right now, the book club's free. You come and join us. Anyway, ad over. But what I wanted to say was somebody mentioned, I think in the first episode, we talked about how our current bishop sort of offhandedly referred to our church as evangelical, which, you know, our church kind of having a lot of the same experiences as we did, like that rubbed us the wrong way. Like, that's not what we think of ourselves as, you know. But she, you know, she clarified that ultimately she's thinking about it as like not a bad thing. You know what I mean? Not necessarily like MAGA or like Trump voter or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's a way of being a Christian. That's, you know, in the broad tent of the Anglican Church, it's a way of being a Christian that emphasizes, you know, certain aspects of faith rather than other aspects of faith. So Anglo-Catholic, Anglicans are more, you know, the emphasis of their faith is more on the ritual aspects of the sacramental aspects of faith. So attending the Eucharist is very, very important to them. Whereas evangelicals, the other things are important to them, like having a warm personal faith, discipleship to Jesus, like all of those things are part of kind of the nexus of what it means to be an evangelical. And so I think, you know, you're talking about like it's complicated. And I think it is complicated because there are, I have to grapple with, I think I'm always going to have this way of being a Christian that was instilled into me. And there are, you know, aspects of the Bebbington Quadrilateral that I appreciate. And there are aspects of that that have just gotten into my bones.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, those are the things I care about.
Yeah.
I care about discipleship. I care about spiritual formation. I care about, you know, having a personal faith. I care about those things. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, maybe one way to name that is, yeah, maybe I'm still an evangelical in some ways, you know?
But, you know, listener, I think we share the story not to, because I think it connects with pieces of your story. Maybe even in the ways it's discontinuous or not the same with you helps clarify where you are. But also to say, maybe it does, maybe it does align with you, and maybe this continues with you, like as we're sharing this.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I felt discouraged about or frustrated about or sad about is that part of what I really believed 10 years ago is like, unless I'm in this group, my faith isn't legitimate. My concern for the scriptures isn't faithful. My Christianity isn't, you know, valid.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's part of the ways that, just a 7-second rant, that's part of the way supremacy cultures gatekeep and police boundaries to create in-group belonging. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't make it true.
Yep.
So hopefully this story is a permission giving, a validation. Maybe even it spurs you to do some of your own praying and reading and thinking about things. But really our hope isn't to tear, there is no Vatican City for the evangelical church. So I'm not trying to tear them down. There's nothing, I don't know what I would tear down, you know?
There's no headquarters to target.
We're not storming Wheaton.
Is that the headquarters?
I have friends at Wheaton. I have friends that teach at Wheaton. One of them will be on the podcast soon. I actually think it's just to give an increasing number of people. Mm-hmm. Ben, I read a statistic, and I'm just going to quote it willy-nilly, and I'm not even going to source it. I'm just going to throw it out there into the ether.
It's on a podcast, quoted on a podcast, unsourced, so you know it's true.
I read that the Southern Baptist Convention has lost an entire Episcopal church worth of members.
Yes. I forwarded you that statistic. That's Ryan Burge. Yeah. 1.5 million. I think it was 1.5 million members. Which is how many people are in the Episcopal Church.
I don't know. So I guess I just share that to say there's a mass exodus.
Yeah.
I saw another statistic that white evangelicals, churches, have lost somewhere between 6 and 10 million people since 2016.
Yeah.
And so I think we share this story maybe to say me too, but also just to say like that's a sizable chunk that for one reason or another, and it's not all because of MAGA, but it is all because of, a lot of it is because of this cultural moment we're in where we seem to be on the wrong side of power and where we are not open to receiving correction from the scripture about it.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, if that's you, you're not alone.
Yeah.
I guess is what we want to say.
Yeah. I think I'd also want to say too, there's all kinds of ways to be a legitimate and faithful Christian.
Yeah.
Like leaving your evangelical church. I used to think that would have meant I left the faith, but man, there's just so many ways of being a faithful, committed Christian. So I want listeners to hear that as well. Like if you do, like you don't have to leave, but if you feel like you need to, like you don't need to leave the faith if you don't feel like you need to do that. If you want to hold on to your faith, there's all kinds of ways of doing it. Yeah.
That's a good word, Ben. I needed to hear that today, I think.
Good. Before we close, Matt.
Yeah.
You like to grow a garden every year?
Yeah, peppers, tomatoes.
You like the peppers? You like the hot peppers?
I love the hot tomatoes. Peppers.
Yeah. We moved into this new house last year. Last summer, we just didn't get around, doing the garden. I've been thinking about what I want to do this summer. We put in a fence. And so anyway, there's a bunch of stuff that we have to think about. But I was thinking about how last summer I wanted to grow some herbs in my garden, but I just couldn't find the time.
The student has become the teacher.
I just wish Christy would have been here to hear me say that.
Oh, so. Maybe she'll listen. And
maybe she'll listen. Christy, you'll have to let us know.
She'll be so
what
proud
your
of
response
you,
was. Yep. Because I would have hoped that she didn't know a dad joke was coming. But I don't know. I had to shift pretty hard into that one. From leaving evangelicalism to gardening.
Yeah, well, yeah. You did anyway. It. You did it, man. Right. I'm so proud of you. And let the dad jokes continue.
Amen.
All right. Amen. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Next time.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.